Welcome to Making Change, a podcast of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. I'm Hilde Gottlieb, author of The Pollyanna Principles and president of the Community Driven Institute. It is my privilege to host this podcast where we talk with change leaders from around the world about this sector's potential for creating visionary social change. I'm so pleased to have Brett McNaught as my guest today on Making Change. Brett is the Vice President of International Programs for Build On, an organization that joins after-school programs in the U.S. with communities in developing countries to build schools. Through those efforts, Build On builds stronger communities both in the U.S. and in those developing countries. Before joining Build On 5 years ago, Brett was a construction manager for Habitat for Humanity in New Orleans, and his background prior to Habitat includes time spent in the West African nation of Niger in the Peace Corps. Through his work with the Peace Corps, his work with Habitat, and now his work with Build On, Brett has seen what works and what doesn't in creating social change both domestically in the U.S. and abroad in developing countries. And so it is my pleasure to have Brett share his observations with us today here on Making Change. Welcome, Brett.
Thank you, Hilde.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. Could you tell us a little bit before we get started about Build On and what you guys do?
Sure. Since 1992, Build On has been working in both developing countries and domestically here in the U.S. And what we try to do is empower people to transform their lives by partnering after-school programs in the U.S. with communities in developing countries to build schools. In the U.S., we have intensive service-based after-school programs in 118 high schools across the country. They focus on doing community service within their communities. That's working with elderly, homeless, veterans, children, and all kinds of different organizations within their communities. They also get some intensive global education based on where we operate internationally and what's out there, what the situation is like in other countries. And at the same time, they do fundraising to build schools internationally. So they get actually to play a part in a much bigger piece of the world by trying to help others get education for themselves. And then what we're able to do through a program that we call the Trek for Knowledge is send two kids from each high school every year to one of our sites, either in Mali or Nicaragua, Malawi or Haiti, to help build a school. So they work alongside the communities for 2 weeks from the ground break through the walls going up of a school. They live with the community, they do cross-cultural interaction, and they really just get a really profound experience that they can take back home and really, really change their lives in a big, big way. Internationally, which is what my focus is, we engage communities by partnering with them to help them realize their dream of building a school. And this is usually a 2 or 3 classroom school. During the day, once it's built, they use it for primary school, grades 1 up to grades 9 sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then after they build a school with us, the adults and some of the children who are too old to start in grade 1, mm-hmm, are able to do a 2-year community education program, adult literacy, life skills. We do health, hygiene, income generation, yeah, better agriculture practices. This is done at night. So during the day, it's a government run or another NGO will run our schools during the day. And at night, it's a build-on-run adult education program. So it's been really successful. And
wow.
We've been able to build now 360 schools since 1992 in 10 different countries. Over 136,000 kids and adults have received their education in build-on schools.
Wow. Wow. I'm breathless. This is wonderful. This is wonderful. Given the breadth of your experience, starting in the Peace Corps in Niger, working domestically here in the U.S. with Habitat, and your experience with Build On, when you look at organizations, groups, local groups, individuals that are really making a difference in creating social change versus those that are not, what do you see as happening in groups that are really creating the kinds of change that we all want to see?
Well, I think it's looking at whoever the group is that you want to work with, whether it's an individual or a community, looking at what they have, not looking at what they don't have, but looking at what they have, the resources available to them, whether it's time or insight, the ability to oversee a project or the intense eagerness to get something accomplished, the ability for people to speak multiple languages to get things done or to work within a corrupt environment. I think just utilizing the resources that people have and working with people who see whatever your goal as an organization is as their goal. They should really be coming to us. If they want a school, they should come to us first. We don't go driving around in the rural parts of Mali or Nepal, going into villages and asking them if they want a school. Of course, they're going to say yes. But we have tens of villages coming to us on a daily and weekly basis, asking us for a school, knowing what our methodology is, knowing what they already have to do to get one. They come to us, and I think that's the number one thing, is that they're bought into the project way before we even know who they are. And when that happens, it's successful.
You know, these things seem to be so logical, and anybody listening would say, well, yeah, of course. Are there groups that are not doing it that way? Are there groups where they're going in and offering it rather than having it come from the community? Are there groups that actually are not looking at the resources that are there and coming in from the deficit mode? It's hard sometimes to even fathom that.
I think so. I mean, it takes a lot of pre-planning, a lot of work with the community to gain their trust, to understand their internal dynamics, to understand what their resources are before you can have a successful project. And I think a lot of times that time is a factor, that there are deadlines to be made, that there are mandates that are given to organizations where they need to produce a result. And quite honestly, we could build schools in communities, whether it's creating lasting change or not, the schools are still going to look the same. But in order to do it correctly with the most buy-in, it takes a lot of time. There has to be a mutual respect, a definite trust in order to get the community to do everything that they possibly can. We expect, rather than just going in there and constructing a school in Nepal or in Haiti or Nicaragua, when a community comes to us and says they want a school, they already know that they have to contribute the land, they have to contribute the water, in most cases the sand and the gravel to build the school, which takes hours and hours of work and sometimes is very physically difficult to do.
Right.
And then at the same time, once we do start a project, they have to oversee it with a committee of 6 men and 6 women each and every day of the project. They're out there working, they're meeting once a week to see how the project's going, and we have volunteers out on the work site every single day, usually on average 20 to 30 volunteers.
And these are volunteers from the community?
Exactly. They're doing everything from bringing the water to the site to mixing the cement, learning how to lay bricks, helping out our skilled labor with all of the activities that go into building a school. So at the end of the day, they know how to run a project, and it's good that it's a tangible project because they can actually see the results, but they know how to run a project together, how to work together.
And so they're actually the ones building it.
Exactly. They actually know how to physically build a school after the fact, and they're able to build their homes better, to build their churches, places of worship better. They're able to work with other organizations and government agencies better once this is all done. And that's what really takes a lot of time. That's what really takes the buy-in from the community, that this is a priority for them. Before we went to them and told them what it was, that they'd already identified.
As I'm listening to you, what's occurring to me is that you guys are almost really just one more resource they're using to get what they need and they want. It seems like it's really coming from the community. They need sand, they need government approval, and they need you. But
yeah,
that it's
absolutely.
That you're just one more tool that they're using to get the things that they want already.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're not in the business of going in and around and convincing communities that education is important. I mean, we're working in developing countries that on a lot of different scales are extremely poor, extremely mm-hmm. needy in many, many ways, but they've already identified education as the way out. And we're not spending a lot of time trying to convince them that education is the way. They already know that.
Right. Of the schools that you guys have already built, are they all still operating? Are there programs still going on in all of them?
Yeah. Out of all the schools we've built, they're all functional. We normally have the government who runs the school during the day, and then we run the community education programs for the adults at mm-hmm. in the evenings. But we have a really strong relationship with communities, because what we've also found is that we don't jump around the globe trying to build one school here, one school there, or even within a country. We focus for a long-term period in one region. So we're working with the local government for maybe 10 to 15 years.
Wow.
The same local government, the same communities. In Mali, for example, in this small region within Sikasso in Mali, we've built nearly 150 schools just in this one small region. So everyone knows who we are, how we operate, and they also know from the government standpoint that we only continue to work there as long as teachers are teaching in our schools, as long as our schools are being maintained. So we're able to have a constant presence. And I think if we left that for the ability to potentially grow faster as an organization and started going into many other countries and effectively chasing the money, mm-hmm. that we wouldn't be as effective, because we're really effective because we're in one place for a long period of time, right. And create the relationships that need to be created and create the leverage, you know, with our government partners that they know that as long as they're upholding their end of the bargain, we're going to continue to work there.
Yeah, and I'm curious, as I'm looking at the adult literacy portion of this, who is doing the teaching? I'm assuming at some point, is the teaching being handed off to folks in the community that are doing the teaching?
Exactly. In most all of our villages, actually in all of our villages, there are normally a few people, a handful of community members that are literate to the degree that we can teach them how to teach others.
Mm.
So we would take two or three community members from each village that we build in and put them through a very intensive training, you know, sometimes a month long, or where we teach them how to effectively teach adults. And we also have education coordinators, what we call them, on our staff that oversee this. And then they go out to the communities every couple of weeks and sit in on the classes and make sure that the facilitators that are based in the communities, you know, have the resources they need to do their jobs.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Another thing that I think is really important as far as keeping things really going is within our communities, we'll build a two or three classroom school depending on the need. And then we'll do this community education program. And then as long as they continue to effectively send all of their children to school mm-hmm. to the best of their ability, boys and girls equally, the rich and the poor, if they're able to do that, and if they have the need for more classrooms, we would go back there, you know, after 2 years, we'd build another two or three mm-hmm. classrooms, after another 2 years, another two or three classrooms, to where as they grow as a community and as their need for higher education grows, then we're able to build up to 9 classrooms so they can have up to a 9th grade education before those now teenagers need to find a bigger city mm-hmm. to go to secondary school.
And this is all happening within the village?
Absolutely, yeah.
Wow. One of the things that's occurring to me as you're talking is that we're very used to, in the Western world, coming in with our expertise and our knowledge and our wisdom and giving that. It sounds like you guys are reversing that entirely, that you're really tapping on wisdom that's in the community. When you're talking about trust and buy-in, you almost have to be as much open to learning and maybe thinking that the thing you were going to do may not even be right as we are used to being right all the time.
Absolutely. And I think one of the keys to that too is that we rely and are blessed to have a really good staff of local people in every country who are from the same villages. They've gotten education, they've gotten out of the the cycle of extreme poverty. They've gotten educated, and now they're giving back to their country through working for Build On. And they really know how to work with the communities. You know, I've spent the better part of the last 10 years living and working in these communities, but I can't pretend to say that I walk into a community and I say, oh yeah, this is a good one. They're ready. I've actually never said that. I always would go in and with the observer's eye, but when I walk out, I haven't promised them a school. I have a meeting with my local team and I say, are they ready? Because, you know, there are so many nuances culturally and so many things that I would never be able to pick up on no matter if I live there for another 10 years.
Right.
So we really try and rely on our local staff to really be able to work with the communities in a really positive way.
How are you teaching that to kids here in the U.S.? I'm curious when you're working with the kids that are eventually going to go into these countries and help build schools for a couple of weeks, what portion of that non-construction, I mean, it's really easy that you go in, here's some bricks, here's how you're going to help build. That's the easy part. I'm wondering how you teach the trust building, the keeping open.
I think it's the same thing. In most of our schools, it's primarily urban high schools where we're working in that don't have a lot of, you know, great resources available to them. We're working in the Bronx and Brooklyn, in Connecticut, in Stamford and Bridgeport. We're also working in Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, Oakland, and San Francisco. And what we're doing is it's a voluntary program. The
right.
The Build On After School program is completely voluntary. And kids join because of word of mouth, because their peers have had such great experiences with it, because we've sent kids from their high school to Mali and to Nicaragua, and they've come back like so eager to share what their experiences were that it gets people excited. So once they join a Build On After School program, they're excited about the possibilities. They get to see how they can really make a big change within their community. They're doing all sorts of projects individually during the week. They're volunteering to help the elderly or to tutor a younger child in reading and writing, or they're working at a homeless shelter.
This is all in communities that we would normally think of, again, an outside agency would come in and want to help them. You're really teaching them in their own communities here in the U.S. the exact same thing you're doing internationally. They're building it on their own resources, on what they do have.
Exactly, exactly. And we partner. I think we're great help to all of the other NGOs and nonprofits that are operating in, you know, in these communities in Detroit. There are community gardens, there are veterans groups, there are elderly homes. These are nonprofits that are desperate for volunteers, desperate for good people to make good commitments, to show up every time they're supposed to show up, and to really create bonds with the people that they're trying to serve. And that's what we're trying to do, is just get our kids engaged in such a way that they just become empowered to transform what they think they can get out of their life. And the kids that really, really latch on to that are so inspired and courageous to want to go on a trek to Mali or to Nicaragua. They get the opportunity to. It's all based on their efforts and their desire to go over there, and it's completely paid for, and it has nothing to do with the income of their family or their means, but they get the opportunity to go over there, and when they come back, they spread the word, and it just becomes contagious.
I'm just thinking about the power of a kid who, frequently kids don't even go to the other side of town. They don't know that there is something two towns over. Their opportunities frequently are limited, and you're building on their own just imagination of what's possible exponentially.
No, absolutely. Like, collectively, just over the last 12 months, our kids in the U.S. have contributed over 133,000 hours of service. Individually
These are kids that we would normally assume are the ones that need service. I mean, that's the thing that I'm smiling about.
Yeah,
is that
exactly.
you're really building strength on strength and seeing strength where everybody else is seeing weakness.
Right. And I think that's the key, is seeing, like I said before, just seeing the resources that they have. These kids in the U.S. have they've got the spirit of youth. They're excited. They're hungry. They want to see things. They want to have opportunities. And then when they're given it, they just take it and run with it. And we have cases where some of these kids have never gotten out of Detroit or Philadelphia. We also have cases where some of them, their parents came from Haiti, or in the case of one of the young men that I met on a trek in Mali last year, Abdul, his parents were from Senegal, and he's going to high school in the Bronx. He gets to go back to West Africa and is able to communicate with some words in local language with the community that we're building the school.
Wow.
And like for him, he was just blown away, and he had a grin so big on his face the whole 2 weeks that it was inspiring to me and obviously to him. And I've talked to him since then over the last couple of years, and he just continues to do great things, both academically, as he takes his education more seriously because he sees that kids in Mali are dying to go to school. They're so excited. They're so proud to attend school every day. So he's now inspired, even though the education in the Bronx, economics in Philadelphia or Detroit is not on par with a lot of places in the country, they still have opportunities available to them that most kids in developing countries don't have.
Wow.
And they see that. And they can share it even with the kids that aren't able to go on the trek.
Wonderful. Well, Brett, thank you so much for being with us. I could talk with you absolutely all day long, and I'm hoping that we can do this again soon. But thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome, Heldy. Thank you.
Talking with Brett, I can't help but think that creating social change goes beyond just looking at what people have versus what they lack. The stories Brett shared are really about something more than simply building upon strength. In the work we do at the Community Driven Institute, we've recognized that that something more is actually the critical difference between working for a community and working with them. And that's why Brett's stories resonate so clearly. When an organization is working for a community, they may really believe the community is strong, but their actions suggest the community is, in fact, weak, made stronger by the expertise of the organization. These programs usually start by generating a plan or an idea on their own. They may then bring that plan out to the community for input, a survey or a focus group or a needs assessment. They adjust the plan based on that input, head out to find funding, and then create outreach programs to attract people to the program that the organization has built for them. The exact opposite holds true when an organization is working with the community. And that's the process Brett described, where the organization assumes the community already knows what it needs. The organization then becomes one of many resources community members can use to achieve their own goals. From the very beginning of the planning, everyone is bringing their expertise and wisdom to the table to build the program together. From there, it doesn't take a lot of outreach to let people know the program is there or to convince them why such a program will help them, because it's the people themselves who've built it. As we've observed in our own work, organizations who work for the community as experts indeed want their programs to be effective. They just don't know how to make that happen. So what have you seen work well? What does it take for organizations to engage with communities to build on the wisdom and expertise that already exists there? What does it take to develop programs side by side together with community members, each adding their own brilliance to the mix? Sounds like we have the makings of another great topic to explore together at the Making Change discussion group at LinkedIn. If you're not already a member of that group, just type Making Change into the search box at LinkedIn to join the group and join the conversation. And of course, you can always find great ways to connect as well as other terrific information at the Chronicle of Philanthropy's website, philanthropy.com, or follow the Chronicle on Twitter at @philanthropy. We hope you've enjoyed this edition of Making Change. If you have ideas for guests for this podcast, folks who are driving new ways of thinking about what it takes to create visionary social change, please get hold of me on Twitter, I'm at Hilde Gottlieb, or at our website, communitydriven.org. Thanks for listening and for wanting to create a better future for the community and for our world. For the Chronicle of Philanthropy, I'm Hilde Gottlieb. We'll see you the first Thursday of next month here on Making Change.